I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and I'm here for one of a series of podcasts around legacy and how you leave something lasting in ephemeral medium like theatre. I'm here with Rachel Tackley, who's currently the director at ETT. She's been here since 2008, and she's about to leave to become the exec director at Chichester Festival Theatre. And Rachel, in the course of your career, you've been through ATG, you've been through Shared Experience, the Albany Half Moon, yeah. Canal Cafe, you've kind of been through every stage.
And you've done your research, haven't you?
Hell yeah. It's not worth doing if you're not going to do it right.
No,
so you've got a really good idea of what the spectrum of what's possible at each part of that ecology is. When you started as the director at ETT, what were you hoping to achieve when you took up the post? Kind of what did you want to change? What did you want to keep the same?
I didn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I've been producing when Stephen was here as artistic director. On a day a week when I was at ATG. And so I was already in the company to some extent. And what ETT was doing then had really good production values, really good work, very, you know, it was, and still is, good theatre for as wide and diverse an audience as possible. It was, you know, proper plays for big audiences.
Yeah.
And it still is absolutely that. So that hopefully that baby hasn't been thrown out with the bathwater.
Yeah.
But because Stephen would direct most of the plays, there was obviously a massive change when I took over. And the thing I didn't want to do was write a list of my 20 top favourite plays and then invite my 20 top favourite directors to direct them. Because...
as tempting as that might be.
Well, actually, it wasn't even remotely tempting. And that's really... that not at all. Because I just felt that everything, because I'm so driven by passion, that the plays that I chose to do had to be driven by a passion, my passion, but also the passion of the director. And I thought much better to meet new directors and re-meet people that I already knew and talk to them about what was on their kind of, sort of what was on their bucket list, I suppose. What were the plays they really, really wanted to do? I wanted to enable creative artists to do the work that they really, really wanted to do. So... not without exception, but almost exclusively, everything we've produced has been driven by the desire of a director.
And that passion. Yeah. That makes for a really different production, I think.
Absolutely, and it makes for a really different production process and a really different working environment. Because if everybody's working on something that they feel really driven about, then you're already, you know, on the third floor. So really, one of my board members describes my job as being a bit like a funnel. And that I sort of get, or kind of hoover up all these ideas, talk to lots of different people, not just directors, writers sometimes. But it seems very strange if I go on a journey without a director. If I go on a journey with just a writer, those are the journeys that I stumble over most commonly, because I really need to have a director in the room with me. And I guess I want more than one person in the room going, hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you just think, is it a good idea? Is this a great play, or am I just kidding myself?
Yeah, and the writer's always going to tell you it's a great play, right?
Yeah, oh God, absolutely. And I guess the other thing about touring is it's perhaps, it strikes me as being even more collaborative, is that even if, you know, I meet a director who I really want to work with and we agree on a particular play or production that we want to do, we've then got to sell it to 10 different venues. So that's a kind of pretty kind of cruel way of finding out whether it's a good idea, bad idea.
Yeah.
You have to then, you know, convince other people it's a good idea, or take it on the chin when they just say, actually, that feels like it's been done before, doesn't feel very new or very exciting, or we had one, you know, the amateurs did that 2 years ago, or, you know. So it's not like being the artistic director of a venue, perhaps, when you're more in control of all the other elements of production. We are, you know, very, very much not in control of the element of delivery.
Mm.
You have to sell it once to the venue,
and then once to the audience,
and to the directors and programmers and marketing teams, and then again to the audience. So I guess it's a bit of a safety net. Maybe I really like that. Sometimes it's frustrating, but sometimes it's a question of just finding the right space for it.
You only want people that love it to be taking it, you know, because then you can continue that.
Yeah, it's like, don't do me a favour, really. You know, don't take it out of some allegiance or just trying to be friendly. You know, it's either, you know, take it because you think it's a great idea, and then we'll find out together or not whether it was or whether it wasn't. I genuinely don't regret anything that we've produced. I might have done some things differently, slightly, but part of the fun is finding out whether that particular show in that particular director with those particular people done in that particular way was a good idea or not, or should have been slightly different. And sometimes a production can work incredibly well in six venues and then just fall down in two. You can drive yourself nuts working out why.
Just, you know, you get those golden moments where the production and the venue and the audience and everyone is just in it and it's wonderful. What were there some of those moments?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, absolutely. There was, because somebody from two or three people from ETT go to every single show and every single venue. So I've seen, you know, been to a lot of theatres and seen a lot of our productions. And there are always productions that you just think, oh, God, I could watch that every night of the week.
Mm.
And there are some productions where you think, okay, right, it's Tuesday, off I go somewhere. Some of the standout moments have been the Roger McGough adaptations that we've done of the Molières, which we call the McGoughiers, and in Liverpool. Mm. And just Roger McGough in Liverpool doing an incredibly funny translation of an already incredibly funny farce is genius. And I, you know, have absolutely laughed so much I thought I was going to fall off my chair. And that's, you know, when your own shows, and you always feel a little bit embarrassed about getting incredibly engaged in your own productions because it looks a bit cynical, perhaps. But so that was fabulous. One of my best favourite ever productions was Jonathan Mumby's production of Twelfth Night, which I just could have watched time after time after time. And I did a couple of pre and post show chats with groups of young people, and just talking to some young people about what they got out of the production. And the thing that I thought was absolutely brilliant was that those kids could go into the classroom the next day and argue with the teacher about some of the decisions that were made and whether they thought it worked or it didn't work. And they were saying things like, well, I did, to be honest with you, I did think I was going to be really bored, but I also thought it was really good. You know, those kind of comments are fabulous. And when you talk about legacy, that's for me the legacy. It's the things that the impressions we leave on minds of audiences.
Yeah.
And I guess it's so much more rewarding, perhaps, if those minds are young, because, you know, it's going to
change
longer.
Something. Yeah,
or it might just give something a little nudge somewhere, just knock something off its axis a little bit, and perhaps start, be the thing that is the moment for people. And young minds are perhaps less cynical. Certainly, you know, my younger mind was significantly less cynical than it is now. So yes, it's incredibly rewarding when those...
So that sort of leads into something else I wanted to ask about sort of long-term versus day-to-day.
Mm.
Because I think a lot of artistic directors I speak to have this idea of, you know, when they leave, what their tenure will have meant.
Yeah.
And then other ones are like, no, it's just about making sure that this week or this year...
Yeah.
We pay our rent, we pay our staff, and the show's good.
No, like, I think I'm one of the long-term ones.
Mm.
That's not to say there haven't been moments when I've, you know, when we had one of the really big productions out on tour, it might have been Amberlynn, it might have been Eternal Love, and we had another production out at the same time, and we were employing over 50 people a week, which for a company of our size is huge.
It's a lot.
And we had to pay them every week, and all of the shows in all of the venues, well, both of the shows in the venues were almost exclusively on split deals. So it was entirely about how much we were taking at the box office. And that was nerve-wracking. So, yes, I guess in those moments it becomes about, are we going to have enough money to...
Are we going to make it to Friday?
Yeah, I mean, I've never allowed the company to become that close to the wire, but certainly there have been times when we just think, you know, this is scary.
Yeah.
You know, there have been, you know, sleepless nights, etc. But no, I'm much more I guess my job is about long term, because everything in touring has to be done at least a year in advance.
Mm.
So it's all been about the plan and the idea and what we're saying about ourselves. And I do spend an awful lot of time thinking about how, you know, what we want to achieve, what the idea is, and why we're doing anything. One of my questions is always, why are we doing this? Who's it for?
Mm.
And why are we doing it? I'm not doing it for me.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm loving what I'm doing, but I wouldn't do anything I didn't want to do. In that I, you know, people have said to me, well, can, you know, I really, really want to direct The Tempest. And it's like, well, you go and direct The Tempest for someone else. And, you know, I don't want to do a Beckett.
Mm.
It's just not my, passion.
Yeah.
So what it is about me, it's about my choices. And as you say, my, you know, my curatorial decisions.
Mm.
It's really much more long term. It's how does that fit into the big picture?
Mm-hmm.
And if I was Mrs. Miggins, my Mrs. Miggins lives in Malvern.
Right.
And
Mrs. Miggins from Malvern.
What does Mrs. Miggins in Malvern think about this?
Mm.
And does she want to come on this journey with us? Is it a journey that we're going on for someone else?
Mm.
I have this whole kind of like random family, and I'm thinking this is for my kind of, you know, pretend brother-in-law, and this is for my pretend auntie, and this is from, you know, da 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 da. So yeah, it's really not about me and my, and I guess that makes me different from most artistic directors who are directors of plays, because often it is about a passion to direct something.
Yeah.
And those artistic directors absolutely have that passion, and I have passion, but it's not about individual production.
And I guess that's interesting because you get to funnel lots of different passions.
Oh yeah. My board member says it's, you know, this Hoover idea is that I start by hoovering up all these ideas with different kind of creative directors, maybe writers, but mostly directors, and then I kind of apply layers upon layers of filters.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to go through the do I want to do it. Actually, the first filter it goes through is, are you a wanker and do I want to
Yes.
And
the secret filter so few people acknowledge.
Absolutely,
yes.
Absolutely. Does it filter? The first filter is really plays we like with people we like.
Yeah.
And then there's a million other filters about, you know, does it fit with the big picture? Is it going to add anything to the sum of what we've done before? Mm. Is it going to take us anywhere new? Is it going to introduce us to new people? Is it going to help develop audiences? Is it going to give the envelope a bit of a shove somewhere along the line? Are people going to like it? Are we going to be able to sell it to venue managers and programmers and producers? Has it been done before? When was the last time somebody did it? You know, all of those things. Are there any great parts in it? You know, a million different filters. And then which is why I think I have to start off with so many conversations to be able to filter it down to the few that come out of the bottom of the filter, that kind of drip out of the bottom. But then at least you've been robust in the decision making.
Mm.
You know, you really have applied all of those filters in an alarming degree sometimes.
Mm.
And it must make it really hard for people that come to meet me, because so often we have these fabulous conversations.
And you get so excited, and then
it goes through three or four filters, and then suddenly you think, you know, you've talked to a venue and they say, oh well, so such and such a company just did that, or I mean, you know, Google helps an awful lot. Because you just, when was it last time? 12 nights.
And sometimes just, you know, I think that's in a slightly different way, but that's something I've experienced, is that artists came to me at Oval House and was like, I've got this brilliant project, and it was brilliant. It just wasn't for us, or it wasn't for us now, or it wasn't for us now on this budget, or whatever, you know. So
I think, I would completely get it.
And you feel awful. You feel often you have such a relationship with those people, you feel like you're almost betraying them.
Yeah, and I think one of my difficulties is that I can never believe that something can't ever happen.
Mm.
Because I'm one of those people that if you put a wall in front of me, I've got to find a way around it or over it or something. So it's really difficult to say no, because it's easy to say no, it's not for me.
Mm.
But then you think, hang on, if it's not for me, what does that really mean? If I run one venue, then I kind of know what that is, but to say no from a touring company perspective means that you have in some way you're admitting defeat because you're saying I can't make that happen given the contacts that we have in many of the theatres in this country.
And surely there's someone and, that will
exactly.
like it somewhere.
And under what? And I suppose for me, I always look at things in a positive way, and I start to think, under what circumstances could this be made to happen? Mm. And then you think, well, it's a great play, and you're a great director, and if you had a great actor in it, then and we took it to these places. So you do have to apply, you know, all 20 filters before you can make the final decision, which makes decision making either incredibly quick and incredibly easy because it's just the tempest and I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Or it's, I'm going to apply 20 filters and really think about this. Mm. And because we never have meetings, I never have meetings with directors and talk about one play. It's always, you know,
a list.
10 or something. Yeah. So it can take me an awful long time to think about things, and I've always got 1,000 plates spinning at the same time. And that must be frustrating for people that are waiting for me to make a decision.
So that's interesting. Do you ever experience any tension between... Because ETT is itself, it's an entity and it has its own aesthetic. And do you ever feel a tension between your aesthetic and ideology and what you want for the ecology and then maybe what the company is? Or are they
No, to be honest with you, I think the company for the moment is me.
Is she?
Yeah, and there's no... I don't think there's any ever any been a real question about that.
Mm.
But that's not to say that the company isn't at times incredibly pragmatic.
Mm.
But no, you know, it's my name on the door.
Yeah.
And things, you know, absolutely. No, I've never felt that the company was anything other than incredibly representative of my view.
Your taste.
Yeah.
That's a really nice place to be in.
It is. Why am I leaving?
So theatre is this ephemeral thing, right? That's the joy of it. That this beauty is transient and that is why it's joyful. Do you think it's possible to leave something lasting, a lasting legacy? Like whenever I start talking about legacy, people go, I don't even know what that is.
No, I think I know what it is. And I think, I absolutely, and I'm not sure that I'd be that interested if I didn't. It's not about, you know, it's not about building theatres for me. I can absolutely get that sense of legacy, you know.
Mm.
That person built that theatre and look, it's still there today and look at who's performed in it and, you know, the memories that have been made in it. I can completely get that. But it's also, you know, not necessarily the thing that's interested me. I mean, Chichester's a really fabulous example. You know, Alan has done the most extraordinary job in bringing about, you know, a £22 million redevelopment. Would I have been remotely interested in his job before that?
Yeah.
No, not at all. I'm interested in making small changes to people's lives, and I'm not going to sit and pretend that I'm, you know, anything we do is going to change the world because it's only plays. But I think it's that if I didn't think that the people that were coming to see our work were going to somehow be changed very slightly by that, then I think it would all be a bit empty. I'm not saying anyone's got to have a, you know, eureka moment every time they walk through the door, but you know, that people will get different things from it. And it might be about the writing and the words that you hear. It might be the you know, the things that you see. I went to see English National Ballet last night, and I was so blown away by the choreography.
Mm.
And I was so blown away by the music. Mm. It happened to be written by someone who I think is a complete genius, who I adore. And I, you know, I didn't come out with a, you know, I hadn't wept buckets. Oh, my God, but that's the thing I love doing in theatre, is having a good cry.
Very good song.
But I think if you can give everybody something to take away with them that will make them think slightly differently. It might be something about it. It might make somebody choose something to wear that's a bit different, which then might have a slight difference on how they're perceived when they, you know, when they meet people in their lives. And you just never know. I think it's so important that you show people what's possible.
Mm.
And then they can take it or leave it. The unique act of sharing a live experience in an audience has got to be about giving a legacy. Mm. Otherwise, watch the telly.
Mm. It's interesting because you just said it's not going to change the world because it's just plays. And I think I want to believe that they can. I'm not sure I do believe, but I really want to.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you. And I do think that we have the capacity. And it does change the world in that it changes the people in the world and it shows.
And the world is the stories we tell about the world, right? So
yes, absolutely that. And I do passionately believe that does that we can, and not that we can change the world, that we do, we already do, because the world would be very, very different without the art generally, but theatre, you know, in this scenario, it would be very, very different. So it has changed the world. It does change the world. It is part of the world. But when I say it's only plays, it's because I'm also not one of these people who, you know, look, I work as hard as anyone else, and we work very long hours, and touring is a very specific thing. So it is all encompassing, and it is, you know, it's a lot of hours, and you have to feel really passionate about it. But we have this saying at ETT, was it's only theatre, can't eat it, can't wear it. And, you know, we shouldn't give up our lives for theatre.
No one's going to die.
No, exactly. I have the kind of, is the world going to stop turning? If ETT doesn't produce a play in March. No, it's not. That doesn't mean to say we shouldn't or we should take it lightly. It just means that if life gets in the way, if people have, you know, I'm a great believer in go home and, you know, go home and be with the people that you love.
Yeah.
Because this is work.
Yeah.
It's passionate work and it's lovely work and we all love it. But, you know, you do have to, you'll be a better person if you have a life.
Yeah, and a better artist.
Yeah, absolutely.
Curator.
And it irritates me a bit when I see friends who are constantly on the end of their mobiles when really it's just ridiculous. Mm. You sort of think, get over yourself. The world isn't going to, nothing much is going to change at 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
You know, really, just leave it.
Okay. Yes, when I get emails from producers, particularly producers, actually, when I'm working as a director at midnight, I think if it's after about 9 p.m,
yeah.
If I get an email from them, I'm like, I hate you, go away.
Well, the thing I think, when I get emails from, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning from people...
You're overstretched.
I just think, what are you doing? But having said that, because I spend a lot of time on trains and travelling... and
that's when you can do it.
And if I need to be back in the office in London at 9 o'clock the next morning, then I am going to be on a train at 7 o'clock in the morning from somewhere, and I will start sending emails. But I make it really, really clear to all my colleagues, I absolutely don't want them to respond. And quite often in the subject title I'll put not for today, or not until you get into the office, or not until 10 o'clock or whatever. Because I'm just a complete hypocrite, because I think
it's that tension between, because we're all doing a job, like most of us are doing jobs that once upon a time we did for free, or we did because we're excited about it. So it doesn't always feel like work.
No.
And if you want to be good at it, it's just about giving yourself permission to stop when you can.
Indeed. But also it's about seeing theatre in its rightful place, which is part of the rest of life. And if theatre becomes the whole of life, then I'm not sure
Not sure how good the theatre is, then.
and we're passionate people in this industry. Yeah, we all are. Yeah. And there's an element of, if you're not on your phone at 9 o'clock at night, then you should be. And it's like, well, you should be having a drink with your mates, or, you know, hugging your kids, or whatever.
Yeah.
So, and the thing about, you know, some of the really beautiful things that I've seen that have affected me most in my life have made me want to go home and hug my kids.
Yeah. And then, absolutely. So, because that's why you make it, right? It's that connection. It's that humanity.
The other type of legacy that I have, that in having this conversation has made me think I must be fairly driven by, are two things, really. One is my presidency of UK Theatre, because that's absolutely about legacy. That's absolutely about changing the industry and trying to make it a better place, where people can work more easily and more quickly and more collaboratively and more honestly. And the other thing is, there's Forge, which we run at ETC, which is a kind of mentoring programme for young, emerging, they don't have to be young, but young as in, not age, but as in...
In their career.
Companies and mostly producers. For me, it was absolutely about... how do I put something back? So I arrive at ETT, and we had an education arm which wasn't being particularly effective in my view. But I desperately wanted to put something back that I felt we were good at. And of course, what we are good at is producing. It's what we do. It's the only thing we do. So we set up Forge, which is it's a kind of like bespoke mentoring program which is incredibly eclectic and not at all strategic. But it's really, I just was meeting lots of young producers who, for the sake of having an hour or two with me or with my colleague Jane or James or whoever, just to ask those questions that you just don't know who to ask. Like, is this a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Do you think it will work? Who do you think would be a good director, designer, lighting designer? Where should we tour it to? What are audiences like and so and so? Do you know this person? Can you put me in contact with that person? Have I remembered everything on the budget line? And usually the answer is no. We've forgotten these three things. And we found that people find that incredibly useful. Yeah. And some of the companies we've been working with for a number of years, in a really ad hoc way, it can be a couple of hours every few months, or half an hour, or an hour a year. Mm. But and people, if we have some spare space, we'll let people kind of do auditions and generally say, look, we're a resource. We will give as much freely as we can in order to put something back. And I really love that. I've loved the people that that we've kind of followed and seen go on to get Arts Council funding and, fairly regular, big chunks of money. And then they go out and do these fabulous tours and the audiences are getting bigger. And now they're starting to emerge onto the mid-scale. Mm. And, all of that's been fantastic.
And I think for emerging companies, that even just having someone you can call,
yeah,
and being able to, I think the thing that I missed before it became the thing that I did all the time was just talking to other people in the industry.
Incredibly lonely, isn't it? Sometimes.
It's so lonely, and knowing how to, it's really odd, but knowing what register to talk to people in so that you could communicate yourself without being a complete wanker.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult because you just don't know how people speak to each other until you start doing it. So even just that tiny thing is massive.
Oh yeah, and I love that because for me it costs me nothing, and I love telling people what I think, and it's then up to them what they want to do with it. It's like not what I think, it's this is what I have found. Mm. So the benefit of my experience is X.
Yeah.
And the benefit of my experience is if you do X, Y will happen. Now you can absolutely should go and find that out for yourself, but if you're forewarned, then that might help you. Mm. And just challenging people on some really basic things, like why are you doing this?
Mm.
And who's it for? And crucially, what if nobody comes?
Mm.
Because we all get so immersed in our own worlds when we're producing plays that we forget sometimes that it's not about us. I mean, it is immediately, but ultimately, the director's going to walk away after the press night, and then that's when it has its most of its life.
Yeah.
So you've really got to think about who's it for, and the number of producers who say, "Oh well, I've only budgeted on 50%," and it's like, "Well, what if those people don't come? How are you going to pay people? How are you going to do this? How are you going to manage it if nobody comes?"
Yeah.
And I think it's only because I've been in that position when you think, "Oh my God." What are we going to do if nobody comes?
20% or 12%.
Yeah. Well, and also, and the thing I say to lots of people that we talk to is, what happens if bird flu happens and people just stop going out? People don't want to sit in closed rooms with 250 other people. What happens if there's some kind of epidemic and people don't want to go out, and literally nobody comes?
I love that contingency planning for the zombie apocalypse. That's brilliant.
Well, it is. But there have been, whenever there's been swine flu or
it hits,
you see audiences nosedive, and that's huge and scary. Or snow.
Mm.
If it snows or floods, then and these things happen regularly. It's not quite a zombie apocalypse, but it's regular things that may go. The question is, if you think it's a great idea, you think it's a great show, of course you do, because you're doing it, and you wouldn't be doing it otherwise.
Mm.
But what if no one shares your passion? What if everyone goes, oh yeah?
The first show I ever produced in London, last week. So you know how you calculate that by the last week.
Oh yeah, you're gonna be selling out.
You're gonna be selling out.
You are. Yeah.
So the last week basically opened with the 7/7 bombings.
Oh my gosh.
So I learned that lesson really hard and really quickly.
I've never used it. I've never used the semi-self bombers. So yeah, you're right.
It was a tragedy. And you say you weren't thinking about the, you know, the bottom line. But then at the end, you know, a few months later, you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
That hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It did. And they do. And it doesn't stop you doing it. It just means you should think, okay, well, I need to make sure that this is covered or that I employ people in such a way that that can be got around, or, you know, I have to have a clause in my contract, or, you know, whatever. You have to have a conversation with people. It's about openness, really. Being open with people and putting and presenting choices rather than saying no or yes.
Mm.
So the answer is always yes. It's just...
What yes to?
Yeah, and if the answer's always yes, what are the consequences of saying yes?
Mm.
So, you know, you can have your helicopter in Miss Saigon if you want a helicopter. Of course you can have it, but it might mean that, you know, you can only have four people in it and that you haven't got any budget for the lights, you know. So I guess, legacy of the people that I work with and the people that work with me here at ETT, we all share the same values, and I think those values are essentially my values. And I guess they've chosen to work with me because of those values. So that's a kind of legacy, isn't it? That you say this is how I choose to make work.
Yeah.
And these are the people I choose to make work with. And if you share the same values as me, then you'll want to work with me. And if you don't, then you won't. And that's also fine.
And then by osmosis, that affects the whole ecology, I think, because then people take those values forward.
Yeah.
So my last question is, what do you think your legacy is? Both kind of here locally for this company, and then maybe more globally for the arts or theatre ecology or society. Or
I really don't think I can answer that question, because I have no idea. Because it's in the minds of the people that are on a kind of on a macro level that have seen the work that we've done, and those and that legacy, if it, you know, where it exists, will be about my choices, but won't necessarily, you know, it'll be about the director's choices and the lighting designer's choices and the actors and writers' choices, and not mine at all. I don't think I could possibly separate out anything that I could say. It's not to say I haven't got, you know, loads of stuff that I'm proud of, because there's tons of it.
And also, I guess, some of the most important legacies you don't know about till
absolutely. I guess the one thing that did strike me at the time as being different and giving the industry a bit of a nudge was actually being the first producer to run a touring company. Because it seemed to me, having worked in the not-for-profit and the commercial sector, that Arts Council and local authority, local government, knew how to fund buildings, and they knew how to fund creative artists, but didn't know how to fund, and never had funded, a producer who wasn't a director. And so that's probably a bit of a legacy, because now it's commonplace. And it was only took over here 9 years ago. But I'm not so foolish as to think that if I'd rocked up to the Arts Council and said, please can I have £500,000 worth of funding to run my own touring company, that they would have said yes, because they wouldn't have. You know, ETT was here. It had a building, it had a life, it had a reputation. So I was only, you know, I was just running with what Stephen had created. I was just running in a slightly different direction. And now it seems that it's commonplace to think now, when you're looking at finding a new creative head of a company, it's commonplace to think, should that be a director who directs? Should it be a producer? Could it be a writer? Could it be an actor?
It's commonplace to lay it open to all of those things.
And it's exactly what ETT has just done in finding my replacement. It's all about, you know, groups of people, maybe. Maybe it's somebody, you know, a director with some associate artists, or a writer with, you know, a director, or, you know, an actor with a producer. You know, it could be... I think we need to keep refreshing those ideas, because I don't think ETT and, you know, producer-led touring companies are the only way forward and are the, you know, the ultimate. It's just part of the mix.
Yeah, an interesting way forward.
Yeah, and I think if we... And I'm glad that we've now... When I was working at Shared Experience, we were having an absolute ball, the time of our lives. I absolutely loved being there. But I think towards the end, I started to think, wouldn't it be great to be the person running, like really running this company? I loved Nancy Meckler, saw her last night, you know. She's an absolute genius. But I suppose I thought, you know, in moving forward, wouldn't it be lovely to have my own company? And I sort of put that to the back of my mind because I thought it's so impossible, it's never going to happen. And then went to work in commercial theatre, where, of course, producers have their own companies all the time. And then I guess I saw this opportunity and went for it. But, you know, again, the collective courage of the funders and the board in making the step.
Taking the risk.
Yeah. And taking the risk. So I guess that's a bit of a legacy. And I do love watching the young people. God, that sounds patronising. Seeing the work that new companies do that have gone through Forge. Mm. I mean, just fabulous. Absolutely. And meeting new people with new ideas who are going to be absolutely, you know, kicking at my heels. And you know, bring it on. I think if we can inspire the next generation, then that's a wonderful thing.
Mm.
And it doesn't matter to me if I haven't got a, you know, building that I built. My husband builds theatres, so he can walk around them and go, oh, you know, that, I remember that time we nearly put that there or moved that there, or that was a different colour, or
that.
So
it's a family that's covered.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, it's not my thing at all. I think my legacy is really in the minds of people, not in bricks and mortar.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.